The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The message boards on letsrun.com are a great place for endurance athletes to get together, talk about their training methods, the best and worst shoes for marathons, or argue about why it looks stupid to wear shorts over compression tights. It's also a hub for internet vigilantes, who comb through data to make sure that runners are telling the truth about their accomplishments and out them when the numbers don't add up. My guest, Martin Fritz-Huber, is a contributor to Outside Magazine, where he wrote about Let's Run message board vigilantes. And Martin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So aside from the compression tights faux pas, what are some of the more serious offenses that have been discovered and shared on these message boards?
The users of these message boards have a habit of scouring race results online, and every now and then they will detect something, an anomaly, that will seem strange to them, and at closer inspection they will discover that, in fact, there are adults that are cheating in major races like marathons or 10Ks, and they are then exposed on these message boards. I'd say that's maybe the most grievous offense that these message boards tend to discover.
Do you have any examples? I mean, it's hard to even know how one would scour through race results. You know, for something like, say, the Boston Marathon, there are thousands and thousands of people that are doing this.
Right. Well, I think something that's important to remember is people aren't actively, in most cases, looking for cheaters. I think they are finding them completely accidentally. I think the appeal of looking at race results is very connected to the way sports fans have always enjoyed looking at box scores. If you're a baseball fan, you love looking at box scores in the newspaper, ditto for basketball fans. And in 2016, if you're a runner and you can participate in a major race, everything will be available online afterwards, not just your race times, but your split times. And if you enjoy running and racing, that you tend to have a habit of looking through them the next day, you see who was as fast as me, who was slower than me, and then something might come up, say, why did this runner not register on the timing mat at, say, the 15K mark? And you might look that runner up and see that that runner has run in previous years, and in every year, or the last 5 years, that runner has not registered, that runner's chip, I should say, has not registered on precisely that mat. And that is exactly what happened in the Marine Corps Marathon in Washington, D.C. last year. And that eventually resulted in the runner, a man named Gregory Price, being issued a lifetime ban from the race.
So Gregory Price, who you're talking about, he was shortening his route. He was skipping a part of the race to shorten the overall marathon distance. There was somebody else that you wrote about who had invented a race entirely.
Yes. I mean, this is arguably the most famous case of cheating in running. And there was a long New Yorker story about a runner named Kip Litton, who is a dentist in Michigan, and who many years ago had set a goal for himself to run a sub 3 hour marathon in every U.S. state. What happened was he eventually was outed again on Let's Run. Like, people started to notice, like, hey, wait a second, like, who is this guy? His results don't add up, and not just like the race splits, but also photos from the race are usually, if you're running in a major marathon, there will be pictures, right? Because there's these companies that specialize in taking pictures of people on the race course and then selling them.
Sure, sure.
And this guy was almost like a phantom runner. Like, he would be at the beginning of the race and he would be at the end of the race, and you wouldn't see him in between, and this really gained suspicion. And again, through these message boards, attention was brought to this person.
Now, how has the website itself and the founders of Let's Run, how have they responded to these types of posts? Do they endorse them? Do they stay neutral? Or does it just sort of happen you know, with or without their intervention?
Well, they absolutely do intervene in cases, I think, where they feel that the allegations are justified. Another famous case was a man named Mike Rossi. I refer to him in the article as well, who last year ran in the Boston Marathon. And I think he took his kids out of school so they could watch him run the Boston Marathon. Got a lot of attention for that. And on closer inspection, it turned out that in all likelihood, this man had cheated in the race that gained him entry to the Boston Marathon.
His qualifier,
yes. And this was something, again, an issue raised on the message boards. And the person, the two guys, the brothers who started Let's Run, they looked into this case and said, hey, these guys are right. Like, this person very likely did cheat. And so they took an active hand in it and then would actually issued a challenge to this guy, Mike Rossi, saying, look, if you can repeat this performance, you apparently did to qualify for the race, we will pay you $100,000. And so he had 12 months to do it. And I think he still has a couple months time and has yet to take them up on the offer.
Wow. I mean, even if he cheated, he should have started training right off the bat.
I would think so, because, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's not like he ran some kind of Olympic-level time. So I think there was a real chance for him to make money in that case, it would seem to me. But the fact that the founders of Let's Run were willing to do this, to put up that much money, I think is a sign of dedication on their part to really fighting for the integrity of their sport and to take the side of the vigilantes that are on their message boards.
Now, there are other community-based websites, Reddit, for example, that have been criticized for this sort of, you know, armchair sleuthing. Actually, speaking of the marathon bombing, after the marathon bombing, there was some fingers pointed and then criticism towards the sort of crowdsourcing investigations. Now, has anybody on Let's Run been falsely accused or gotten upset over some of these accusations?
I think, there are cons because it's not really curated. And if you go on the site and you look at it, it's not every message board post will even be about running.
Right.
It'll be people seeking, you know, marital advice. And when I spoke to the founders of Let's Run, they said, they try to control it a little bit so it doesn't get too out of hand. But for the most part, they just kind of let it kind of run its course. And yes, there are cases where, you know, there'll be conspiracy theories or things that might be kind of way off about, like, professional runners. I think you just have to accept that for the most part, there will be these things that are off base. But when things are credible, over time, they will assert themselves. And in a sort of laissez-faire style, if there is something to allegations and enough people come forward, then it will speak for itself, especially when there is evidence available online in the form of race results.
Martin, are you a runner?
I am, yes.
Is there something specific, do you think, about running culture compared to maybe other sports? Something about running that you think explains why this community would be so intent on driving out cheaters themselves?
Yeah, I just think that runners do it very much for themselves. And I think people work very hard to achieve the results that they do when they train for a race. And it's a very solitary endeavor. It's really, you do it for yourself. And the only way, or the real appreciation for the sport, has to come from yourself. And when people kind of cheat in races, the people that put in the work, they take real offense to that.
Martin Fritz Huber is a contributor to Outside Magazine. You can find a link to his article, How Online Vigilantes Take Down Cheating Runners, at wordofmouthradio.org. Martin, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Often the Western media portrays Sweden as a modernist utopia, where blonde-haired trendmakers export up-tempo pop music and sleek design, whilst the government offers up unparalleled maternity leave and a long history of generous immigration policies. But this is not how Sweden is depicted in Michael Booth's book, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. Booth is British-born, but he's been living in Denmark for many years now, and in his book he wryly describes Swedes as a stiff and conformist people paralyzed by good manners and their government as a sort of benign totalitarianism. The book comes out on paperback next month. I spoke to Booth when it was first published.
When I moved to Denmark, I discovered there was this weird kind of dysfunctional family relationship up here with the Swedes. They're kind of like the older brother, the head boy, the goody-goody. And they've generated quite a deal of resentment amongst their neighbours and envy over the last couple of hundred years, really. So it was that kind of weird relationship that got me started. I mean, the Danes, well, basically the Swedes won, right? They won history. They won everything. They're rich, successful. They won the territory. They beat the Danes.
They've got IKEA.
They got IKEA. They got Tetra Pak. They had these massive global brands. They had this amazingly well-functioning secular industrial society. And they have remained neutral for a couple of hundred years, supposedly, whilst selling arms to the rest of the world. There's a good deal of kind of accusations of hypocrisy from the Finns and Danes in particular. The Norwegians don't like them terribly much either.
Now, you did a lot of traveling through Scandinavia. You live in Denmark, but you visited all the other countries. And Sweden especially has a very interesting stereotype of a person who's, as I mentioned, stiff, very conformist. Did you find that that was the case in your experience?
Well, yeah, and it's not really me that's kind of decided this. It's this, if you ask the Swedes themselves, this is their self-image. It's quite interesting. When there are international surveys done for people to describe themselves in adjectives, the Swedes just use words like stiff, remote, humorless, rule-obsessed. You know, they don't have a very great self-image compared to the Danes, who always describe themselves as the happiest people in the world. And the Swedes do, yes, they do tend to live up to some of their stereotypes. They, you know, Greta Garbo famously wanted to be alone. She was a Swede. Mm-hmm. I always used to think that was just kind of some kind of shtick, but it's true. The Swedes do have isolationist tendencies. It is a huge country, a huge landmass. I think the second largest in Europe, and they have traditionally lived kind of spread apart, not very densely populated. So they're used to getting by themselves. They also have what's called a very high context society, which means that they all are kind of homogenous. They think the same. They eat the same food, drive the same cars, wear the same clothes, see the same films. They think in the same kind of way. In the book, I have a rather kind of flippant chapter where I go to Stockholm and spend a day trying to behave as un-Swedishly as possible.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories from that chapter is where you visited the Nobel Museum and yeah, sort of tested their manners.
I ate a pack of potato chips and slurped my Coke underneath a sign saying no eating or drinking. And I also tried to cross the road on red, which is just not done generally in Scandinavia, and would sidle up to people on benches and try and start a conversation or get into a lift with Swedes and see them leave rather than share a lift with me. They're just not very social people.
Now, do you think the qualities that the Swedes use to describe themselves, you know, polite, conformist, later you talk about lacking in chivalry, do you think these are necessary trade-offs required to live in such a successful welfare state like they do?
No, not really, because there are other successful welfare states in Europe that do without that kind of, you know, I'm English, right? So I'm used to these rather baroque, extreme forms of manners, which I agree are kind of, you know, weird. But if I go into a store in Britain, and I've done this, and I've counted how many times in a transaction to buy a newspaper, how many times you say the word please and thank you. It's like 12 or 13 times. It's all, excuse me, please, thank you. Well, so we have a good welfare state, and we're chatty, right? The Swedes have a fantastic welfare state. They're not chatty. I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Well, so you don't think that there's any connection maybe between the sort of isolated sensibility that they hold and the way that the dependent on the state rather than each other?
No, I think more it's a case of high trust societies tend to create a kind of social network, a social kind of foundation in which welfare states flourish very well, because if you trust each other, if you trust your government and authorities to administer your taxes fairly and to redistribute the wealth fairly, then those welfare states tend to function much better. And that you can see across the Nordic countries, they have high levels of social trust, high levels of social cohesion. The Swedes and the Danes belong to more clubs, associations. They do more voluntary work than almost anyone else in the world. And that certainly helps to knit the fabric of society very closely together.
How does this all connect to the very different history? They're descendants of Vikings, and yet they're now, you know, the most polite peoples we can sort of imagine. How does that all connect?
Well, actually, they're not polite at all. In fact, in my book, I talk about the Swedes as being in the public sphere, the most rude people I've ever met, encountered outside of Hong Kong Chinese. They're incredibly brusque and bad-mannered. You know, if they don't know you on the buses, on the trains, out in public, they use their elbows without apologizing. They don't hold door. You know, they're really, really shockingly rude from an English perspective. And I'm not the only Englishman who's noticed this. So, and that, maybe that's the Viking gene coming out there. I think the whole Viking thing is rather overstated, actually. This was something that happened 1,000 years ago. But, you know, we were learning more and more about the Vikings, about what a complex, actually very civilized people they were.
Right.
But I'm not sure they were more brutal than anyone else.
I'm speaking with Michael Booth. He's author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. I want to get back to a phrase that I mentioned when I introduced you that really caught me reading the book, benign totalitarianism. You weren't the first to use the term, but it really struck me. What is the argument there that Sweden is, in some ways, a totalitarianism society?
Well, we're familiar with the concept of a totalitarian state as one with a one-party ruler that dictates, you know, how the country is run.
Right.
Now, Sweden's Social Democrats pretty much did rule the country for the vast majority of the last 50 to 80 years. So, and yes, there was democracy. Yes, there were elections. But as is the often happens when one party has a lot of power, they took over the judiciary, they took over the media, they took over academia. So social democracy became the national creed, if you like. And so the benign part of it is, you know, they weren't queuing for potatoes like the Russians were. Everyone had a nice car. Everyone had an extremely high standard of living. So again, the wealth was distributed extremely effectively, and they had this fantastic cradle-to-grave welfare state and safety net. So that was the benign aspect of it. I have met Swedes who have complained that they don't feel particularly free when they're in Sweden, and have they indeed left Sweden because certain freedoms are not officially curtailed. But if, for example, you want to be a mother who stays at home to raise her kids, that's not particularly approved of, and the social systems don't particularly support that. So yeah, you're free, but you're free to be Swedish.
To keep the analogy going a little bit, you know, censorship, I suppose, would be a big part of a totalitarian state. And there has been this sort of agreement not to give a far right party, the Sweden Democrat Party, very much airtime during the last election. Now, what's the story there? And does it make sense? Does it not make sense?
I can see both sides of this one. You know, the Sweden Democrats are a pretty odious bunch. They have their roots in the neo-Nazi movement in Sweden. They're bigoted, anti-immigration, particularly anti-Muslim. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed them. They're not particularly appealing, and they have kind of stupid and ridiculous views. Now, to put it bluntly, now in Sweden, none of the political parties will work with them. They've been shunned in parliament since they came in the election before last, actually. And the media has kind of self-censored them. So some newspapers wouldn't accept their adverts. They were excluded from debate programs on TV on kind of spurious grounds. Now, this has kind of backfired because they scored 13% in the last election and have a bigger presence in parliament than ever. And there is a sense that view, that whole dialogue about immigration has become a taboo, and it's rather exploded in the Swedes' faces. This is certainly the view from Denmark, where their own right-wing party has been much more a part of the mainstream for the last 15 years. Indeed, for a lot of the last 15 years, it was the kind of the kingmaker in the government.
So do you have any ideas after writing this book about why the Western media does tend to see Sweden and, in fact, the rest of Scandinavia through such rose-tinted glasses when there is racism, xenophobia, you know, things under the surface, under the main narrative that we would find anywhere else? Why do we see it so perfectly?
Well, first of all, I think they fulfill a need that we all have for a utopia, right? A utopia on Earth. And since the economic crash and the euro crash, we used to dream of a house in Provence or Tuscany or wherever. I think we kind of shifted our eyes north because they offered us a different set of values, a different kind of way, a formula for running society that seemed less capitalistic, less grasping, more functional, more simple, that kind of back to basics thing. And then there's what I call the White Album argument, right? Paul McCartney was once asked by a journalist, he said, shouldn't the White Album have been maybe just a one disc album instead of a double album? Because there were some, you know, filler songs on there that weren't that good. And McCartney said, well, yeah, but it's still the White Album. And, you know, when you say that there's racism and there's xenophobia up here in the North, there is, but not that much compared to other countries in Europe. And things still function extremely well here. These are, you know, I live here of my own free will. It's a great place to live. It's safe. Things work. It's fair. It's equal. And I don't really see anywhere else that's doing it any better.
So as close to perfect as we'll find.
As I say, the book's called The Almost Nearly Perfect People. And I do, you know, sometimes I'm very critical because the media asks me to be critical. But that is genuinely how I feel about these countries.
Well, Michael Booth, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome, Taylor. Nice to meet you.
Michael Booth is the author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. The book is being released on paperback next month. We tend to think about preserving the planet's natural resources as something you do with legislation, with changes in behavior maybe, or processes like recycling. But some natural resources can only be preserved with a microphone. This story about the importance of natural sound comes to us from Carrie Klein.
Kurt Fristrup is standing in the middle of a prairie, and he's the loudest thing for miles. He and I are huddled near an empty cattle pen in Pawnee National Grassland in northern Colorado. Before he pulled out his tools, the silence here was palpable. The breeze carried no sound except the rustle of a million stalks of yellow grass. A family of pronghorn, kind of like furry antelope, padded over to us to investigate.
We have some friends.
Aren't they beautiful?
Kurt is disrupting this serene soundscape for a reason. He wants to better understand it by recording it. Cows chewed through a microphone he set up a few months ago, and he's here to install a new one.
My respect for those cattle has just gone up. They had gnawed through some of these things, and they're pretty tough.
Kurt's a senior scientist with the National Park Service in Fort Collins, Colorado. He's tasked with protecting a natural resource. It's not water or minerals or endangered species. It's sound, natural sound. His team is studying how man-made noise is drowning out the sounds of birds and insects and rain. And as more and more research links our well-being to what we hear, Kurt and his colleagues are pointing to natural sound as something to be managed and even protected.
I'd like to think that we can help everyone realize that their lives could be better and their communities could be in more vibrant places if we take some time to make them quieter.
Most of us can probably agree, our world is pretty noisy. But just how noisy is something Kurt is trying to figure out. For a decade, he and a small team of engineers, physicists, and biologists have hidden microphones in parks around the United States. Some are really remote, think grizzly bears and backcountry skiing, but others are in urban areas, like Civil War memorials and the Statue of Liberty. Each microphone recorded 24 hours a day for a month, capturing fantastic sounds, like the trumpeting of elk and goofy birds called ptarmigans. Not to mention the grunts of bears destroying the microphones. Totally worth it. But what Kurt was after was loudness. Each device measured decibel levels 33 times per second. That mountain of data fed a model that created a sound map of the contiguous United States. It took the qualities of each site, like how close it is to roads or water, and calculated median sound levels for the entire rest of the country, even places outside parks.
It looks very much like the images of the Earth at night from satellites. The brightest noise sources are concentrated in cities, and then you see these lines along the interstates and other major transportation corridors that also light up with sound.
That big picture may not be all that surprising, but the differences in noise levels are staggering.
You and I are standing about 3 feet apart, and you can comfortably hear what I'm saying. In the Sierra, the background sound level is about 1,000 times lower, which means you could stand 90 feet away from me, and I could talk at this level, and you could hear me just as clearly.
Every rise of 3 decibels doubles the sound hitting our eardrums. Now consider this. The loudest places in the U.S. are around 40 decibels noisier than the quietest. So if you do the math, Manhattan can be around 8,000 times louder than Great Sand Dunes National Park, one of the darkest spots on the map.
There are times when I've been in the field in the Intermountain West where I've not only been able to hear my own heartbeat, but I've been able to hear the heartbeat of the person in the field with me.
Our biggest noise producer? Transportation. Cars, buses, motorcycles, and the hiss of tires against pavement. But even far away from roads, there are still airplanes. Kurt estimates man-made noise really took off in the mid-20th century, when flying became commonplace. Now, most of us are so used to planes, we don't even notice them. After hiking with friends, Kurt likes to ask how many they heard.
Most people will say, you know, I think I heard one or two aircraft. And being me, I've actually been counting the whole day, and I'll say, well, we actually heard 21 high-altitude jets, 10 propeller aircraft, and 2 helicopters.
So if we're not even conscious of the man-made noises around us, then what's the big deal?
So what are we going to from here?
Researchers at Penn State are trying to figure that out.
So you're going to begin the study by putting on a heart rate monitor that's going to continuously record your heart rate throughout the study.
That's Heather Costigan, a lab manager at Penn State. She outfitted me for a scientific experiment. It was called the Soundscape Study. The first step was stress. I had to imagine I was applying for a big job and gave a 5-minute speech in front of a one-way mirror. It was kind of intense. Then came the soundscape.
Come over here and have a seat.
Heather whisked me into a dark room. I put on headphones and settled in to watch a video. On the screen was Half Dome, the majestic centerpiece of Yosemite Valley. The sun crept across the granite. Red and yellow leaves fluttered. But when I heard a garbage truck interrupt, then a motorcycle, I cringed.
We would like to know, when is sound helpful? When is noise harmful? Under what circumstances and for what people?
Joshua Smythe is a professor of biobehavioral health at Penn State. He's Heather's boss, and he coordinated the soundscape study. His hypothesis is that natural sound will speed up stress recovery, even with people making noise in the background. But some test subjects watched that video with no man-made noise at all, and Joshua thinks they'll recover even faster. So for each test subject, he and Heather tracked heart rate and also measured cortisol, a hormone in saliva. Cortisol is a kind of stress indicator, and chronically stressed people produce a lot of it. Studies have connected that highly stressed state with all sorts of health issues: heart problems, breathing problems, musculoskeletal problems, and a higher susceptibility to viruses and infections.
So we just generally see a decay in the capacity of the body, again, in response to these sort of chronic conditions of stress.
So when we hear irritating sounds, even if we try not to let them bother us, Joshua suspects that our stress levels still spike, priming our bodies for other health problems. But could noise ever be so bad that it alone breaks down our immune defenses? Probably not.
But if I have that and stress from work and not a particularly supportive relationship and I'm worried about money, then collectively I may be at risk.
So our cars, our airplanes, some of the very advances that make our lives easier and more productive, they might also be sabotaging us. So what's the solution? Stop driving? Renounce technology? A social scientist across campus offers a gentler perspective.
I think that talking about the positive effects of nature sounds is a much better story than talking about the negative impacts we have on the world. Both might be true, but we know that we can focus on the fact that it's important to us and it resonates with people, no pun intended.
Peter Newman leads Penn State's Department of Recreation, Park, and Tourism Management. They study why people visit parks and what they do once they're there.
Listening is a huge part of that experience that people have out there. They want to hear the noises of wildlife. They want to hear the sounds of wind and water. And those are really important things for how they feel.
In the past, studies have shown we recover better from surgery when we can see nature. Peter says we also benefit from hearing it. Research shows natural sounds can improve cognition, mood, and general well-being. And that's an idea a lot of people already buy into. It's easy to find MP3s of relaxing nature sounds. But Peter argues that we can preserve sound in the real world, too. He points to a success story in Muir Woods, a national monument outside San Francisco. In an experiment in 2009, he and a few colleagues posted signs for quiet zones and showed visitors how to be less noisy.
We actually were able to reduce the amount of noise there by about 3 decibels, which was the equivalent of doubling the people's listening area.
Conserving sound in parks may seem to be at odds with the Park Service mission of bringing people there. But back in Colorado, Kurt Fristrup sees these opposing values as a challenge. He knows the solution isn't to keep people away. Instead, he's helping develop new technology, like quieter pavement and electric airplanes that could someday lead silent air tours. His team's also developing roadside noise gauges, kind of like the blinking signs that tell you how fast your car is moving, only it's how loud you are.
I actually look at this as an enormous opportunity to improve not only resource conditions in park, but the quality of the environments in which we all live. Because unlike many other forms of pollution, all of this goes away as soon as we throw the switch.
Throwing that switch won't be easy, but we all have an incentive to try. Because who wants a world in which recordings of nature are our only option? So next time you're outside, turn off your car, stop talking, and listen. What you hear might just be good for you. And it's free, for everyone. Natural sound is a truly infinite resource. All we have to do is not drown it out.
That story, produced by Kerry Klein, was part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
One of you is about to become our new Miss Universe.
Probably the cringiest moment in television last year goes to talk show host Steve Harvey. It was his duty, as MC of the 2015 Miss Universe beauty pageant, to crown the winner.
Colombia!
Which he did. But 1 minute and 55 seconds later, Harvey was forced to backtrack and admit that he had misread the cue card.
The first runner-up is Colombia. It is my mistake. Still a great night. Please don't hold it against the ladies. Please
now,
don't.
Even without epic bungles like that one, beauty contests can be a messy and very divisive business, dredging up questions about sexism, patriarchy, and exploitation. Perhaps they would feel a little less antiquated, and the shows themselves run a little smoother if they were run by robots.
Today, we would like to welcome you to the first beauty contest with an all-robot jury. Robots will look at your picture taken by a standardized app and compare you with millions of others. They will evaluate.
Beauty AI is a contest where human attractiveness will be judged not by a panel of peers, but by an algorithm, a program designed to measure things like symmetry, how wrinkly you are, etc. When we found out about this contest, we at Word of Mouth were a little weirded out, but also very curious. So a few producers and I downloaded the app and gave it a try.
This is so funny.
A human downloads the app, makes selfie, robot jury examines photo.
First, you've got to sign in on Facebook or Gmail. You fill out some personal information, your age, your height, your weight, your ethnicity.
I think I'm 5'6", but I'm going to say I'm 5'7".
You're cheating it. I'm going to do that too.
Then the app gives you a few guidelines about how to submit your selfie.
Okay, to take part in contest, your photo should match the requirements. One, use your own face. Two, no makeup.
I wonder if I'm taking my glasses off.
Three, no facial hair.
From there, you know the drill. Hold camera out at arm's length, adjust hair, smile, or pout, and take the shot. No need to glue on your swimsuit to enter this contest. All you've got to do is take that pic and press submit.
You guys ready to submit?
Yep.
But just because there's no makeup required, no flashy gowns or talent shows, that doesn't mean that this contest is somehow more authentic than the beauty pageants we're used to.
I wonder how many photos people will have taken before they submit one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's like when people post things on Instagram who are model-esque or who have a bazillion followers, they take so many photos before they submit them.
That one that looks casual is never casual.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
How many did you take?
I just took maybe three.
I think I took like 10.
Long story short, we found this whole idea of an AI beauty contest endlessly fascinating. So we got in touch with Alex Zhavorankov, a biogerontologist and anti-aging expert, and one of the human brains behind the very first AI-based beauty contest. Alex, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Pleasure to be with you.
So what exactly are these programs looking for when they're judging human beauty? I mentioned a couple specifics, wrinkles, symmetry. What else?
Well, this competition is a competition for human just as it is for robots. Right now, we are witnessing a silent revolution in artificial intelligence and the technique called deep learning, which is kind of as close to human brain as it can be when you're thinking about machine reasoning. So those are deep neural networks. Several of the algorithms that we've enrolled in the Beauty AI 1.0 are comparing people's faces with basically millions of other faces and pictures of actors, models, essentially pleasant people and looking for similarities in various racial categories, age categories, geographies. One of the algorithms that's going to be evaluating people's faces is going to be wrinkle. That's the algorithm that tracks the progression of your wrinkles as you age and also as you apply various skincare products or cosmetic surgery procedures.
So as you mentioned, this is a competition amongst people who are sending their photos in. It's also a competition for programmers who are sending in their algorithms to be part of the judging. How does that work?
So basically, in order to train an algorithm to recognize, so to speak, beauty or any other pattern, you need a very large collection of standardized data. And in our case, through this competition, we managed to collect a very large number of faces linked to biometric parameters like weight, height, age, and also the social profile. So the programmers can use those parameters to actually create a rating system for every person and then come up with an algorithm that evaluates personal performance.
Okay, so one of my big questions about this contest for the programmers is that, you know, if they're trying to come up with a program that judges human attractiveness, doesn't it still take a human to then judge the programs that they're coming up with? You know, somebody afterwards has to look at it and say, okay, this guy's program, you know, this person who it's saying is the most attractive is not subjectively attractive by all of us people in the room, and therefore that program doesn't work as well. Do you see what I mean about how complicated this sounds?
Absolutely, and that's why initially you will have a jury, so it's going to be a panel of robots and supervised by a human. However, in the future, the intention is to lose the human, just like you will see very similar trends happening in the automotive industry, for example. So soon you will see driverless cars. So initially we're going to train the system, set up a set of rules, and then let it go so robots would be able to kind of even manage themselves.
You know, beauty is often talked about as being in the eye of the beholder. So is there anything, I guess, maybe not dangerous, but is there anything strange about making that eye, the eye of the beholder, a robot who doesn't have its own, you know, senses of what it finds attractive, its own individual sense?
Well, initially, those robots are being trained to think in human terms. So basically, they are going to be comparing the contestants to other beautiful people, but also looking at other parameters like again, maybe social performance and also some biometrics to see if those match the current beauty standards. But later you would want robots to reason and find their own set of rules on how to evaluate humans. I mean, you probably like your Tesla, but does your Tesla like you? That's a good question, right? In the future, you would probably want to have some kind of reciprocal feelings from a machine. So you probably would want to interact with your robot so that it may like or may not like you. So there are a lot of benefits of developing those algorithms. In my case, I'm a biogerontologist. I study aging. For me, there is a lot of value in working with this data to evaluate a person's health and essentially not going from the picture to the health status and then to various interventions.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because I was sort of wondering what the practical applications might be for the sorts of data you're going to gather using this contest afterwards. How are you, as an anti-aging expert, going to be hoping to use that data?
Well, next week we're launching an app that is using the engine, which is very similar to Beauty AI. It's called Wrinkle, R-Y-N-K-L.
Of course.
Right. And that app tracks the appearance of wrinkles with age and also looks at various age-related changes on the human face. And then allows users to essentially start tracking the various interventions that they're using to prevent wrinkles or prevent facial aging, and evaluates the effectiveness of those interventions. So essentially, you would be able to put any cosmetics company's claim to a test and see if the intervention worked or whether it didn't in a very scientific and standardized way.
I'm speaking with Alex Zhavorankov, a biogerontologist and anti-aging expert, about Beauty AI, the very first robotic-judged beauty contest. You probably heard one of the questions that some of the producers and I had when we were taking our selfies was whether or not to smile, because there was a sense that since we were taking this for a robot, we shouldn't. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of standard to smile when you take a picture of yourself. I was wondering how the AI might be able to take that into consideration, or whether or not those of us that smile also have, quote unquote, more wrinkles.
Well, here's going to be an unfair tip for Beauty AI 1.0. So if you smile, you get more wrinkles. Mm-hmm. So wrinkle will definitely assess you as a less attractive person for your age. But many other algorithms that compare you to celebrities might actually give you a higher score because many celebrities smile when they take a picture. The optimal strategy would be to smile in a way Mona Lisa smiles. So basically smile, but not too much.
You know, I mean, I hate to harp on this point, but it seems so strange to sort of leave our ideas about what's attractive in the hands of something that can't differentiate between a person who's smiling and a person who's not. I mean, that's the thing is, you know, all of us are attractive or not attractive based off so many factors beyond a still photograph. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I understand the whole idea of being able to measure wrinkles, but there's something about moving to the next step, which is to sort of say that something is or isn't attractive. That just seems so hard to make that leap.
Absolutely. But there are algorithms that actually can very easily identify whether you're smiling or not and recognize human emotion. So there is a whole field dedicated to that particular task. So in our case, in the first Beauty AI 1.0, the algorithms are going to be somewhat simplistic, even though some of them are deep learned. So it's essentially, or it can be qualified as artificial intelligence. But the next competition and the competition after the next competition are going to attract more and more advanced algorithms. So you'll see robots that will reason and at some point of time will also take other parameters into account that are not only related to your face.
So when do we find out the results of who won this first AI Beauty 1.0?
So Beauty 1.0 results are going to be announced hopefully in the first week of February.
Well, I'm not particularly hopeful for myself, but I know that we at Word of Mouth will be eagerly awaiting the results. Alex, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Alex Zhavorankov is a biogerontologist and anti-aging expert, and he's one of the men behind the first AI-based beauty contest. You can find out more at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Twitter, at wordofmouth, and on Facebook, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. That's where you can join in the conversation and let us know what you think about the Beauty AI contest, the growing role of robots in our personal lives, and whether or not beauty can truly be measured by a set of algorithms. After all, the most interesting discussions take place by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby. Share your thoughts and join us again tomorrow at 2 for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.